Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about a study into patient attitudes towards clinical trials. Some of the public's reluctance to participate in these necessary trials could be traced to earlier studies that were done without consent. One of the most notorious breaches of medical ethics was uncovered in 1972 when it was learned that the U.S. Public Health Service let nearly 400 poor black men go untreated for syphilis in order to learn what happens to a person suffering from the disease. But the so-called Tuskegee experiment was only one example of a medical system that for a long time was racially biased and had few codified codes of ethics or consent laws. But not all of the examples were as overtly damaging as Tuskegee. One fairly simple collection of a tissue sample more than a half century ago had an enormous effect on medicine. Henrietta Lacks was a black woman living in Baltimore in 1951. She was dying of cervical cancer when doctors took a sample from the affected area, which changed the course of medical research. But members of her family never knew of the effect that Lacks' cells had, or that the cells continued to live on in perpetuity until years later. And that discovery had a profound impact on the family's life as well. The story of Lacks' cells and her family are the subject of Rebecca Skloot's award-winning book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke reached her by phone in Chicago in 2011, and she offered a brief primer then about why Henrietta Lacks' cells differed from all the other tissue samples scientists had collected before.
Well, the big difference is that they survived and all the other ones died. So scientists had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And no one knows exactly why that is. The difference between Henrietta's cells and all the others is still a little bit of a mystery, but her cells just never died. So they have been growing and dividing, doubling their numbers every 24 hours since 1951. And we know that she had syphilis, which can make cancer cells grow more rapidly, and she had HPV, which caused her cancer. So there's something about those viruses and her tissues that interacted together to make them grow the way they did.
It was really either the perfect storm or incredible serendipity that they happened to collect her cells and just from the right person and the right person that was doing the looking.
No, absolutely. It was a sort of perfect storm, you know, between the fact that of her cells being as powerful as they were, that she ended up at Hopkins, where the one scientist, George Guy, who was really the pioneer in all this stuff, had developed techniques that would make it possible to grow them. So it was the two of them coming together in that moment was pretty miraculous.
Well, I was hoping we could flash back to pretty early in the reporting process for you. The Lacks family was pretty reluctant to cooperate with you on telling the story. Why was it so compelling for you that you kept at it and jumped through the repeated hoops that were put in your path?
Well, you know, when I first learned about the cells, I was 16 in a basic biology class, and all I knew was that there were these incredible cells that had was really one of the most important things that happened to medicine. They came from a woman no one knew anything about, and she was black. Like, those are the only facts that I knew, and I just felt like I have to find out who she was and what her story was. I had no idea that her family had a story related to the cells. When I first started the book, I thought I was writing a book about the woman that the cells came from and the cells themselves. And my first contact with her daughter, it became very clear to me that something had happened to the family. So her children were actually used in research themselves in the 70s. No one told them that the cells were alive. She had five kids. No one told them until about 25 years after her death, when scientists came back to her kids and used them in research without their consent in order to learn more about the cells. And what followed was just literally decades of trauma for the family related to the cells. And my first phone call with her daughter, she didn't tell me what had happened, but she was so terrified to talk to me. And she kept saying, you know, she was excited about the idea of someone writing a book because then she could finally learn what these cells were and what they did for science, but that she didn't know who she could trust and maybe someone had sent me to take their cells. And none of it really made any sense to me. I didn't understand what she was talking about, but it was so clear that something had happened and that I needed to get to the bottom of why she was so reluctant to talk to me and that I would then understand the whole story. And that took about a year and a half to convince them to trust me and to talk to me.
And as became evident as you read this book, even once you earned their trust, it wasn't a consistent thing.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, and I sort of understood that where they were coming from with that. You know, when I first called, I had no idea where I fit into the larger picture of their story. And really, I was just one in a long line of people, particularly white people, who'd come along wanting something from them having to do with these cells. And it had never worked out for them. And they had never personally benefited. You know, they had a lot of, no one had ever just sat down and explained to them even what a cell was. So they didn't have a lot of understanding of the science. And, you know, an enormous industry had grown out of these cells. People, you know, it was a multi-billion dollar industry. Her kids still, you know, can't even afford health insurance. So there was a lot of anger, a lot of, you know, discrepancies in what they, just the facts of the story for them, but also in what they felt like they deserved and what they'd gotten. So, you know, and in the past they had trusted people who turned out to be there to really take advantage of them. And so, you know, for them, the story of their struggle to trust me is sort of part of the story of what happened to them because of these cells.
Well, one could not read that story without thinking of the term PTSD as we were reading
absolutely.
It.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting threads, obviously, that winds through the book is the evolution of informed consent laws. And I guess it would surprise people that they didn't really exist to any significant degree when Henrietta Lacks was a cancer patient in the early 50s. But it would probably surprise people even more that that if she were a patient today, it's unclear what kind of consent they would need to take those cells today.
Right, yeah, absolutely. In the 50s, I mean, we didn't even have the term informed consent when Henrietta went to the hospital. So, yeah, taking her cells was standard practice, and they wouldn't have thought otherwise. Now, you know, obviously we have a lot of informed consent laws, but it's very it's very inconsistent how they apply to tissues. So if your identity is attached to your cells, that requires consent to take those and research on them, if they were taken specifically for research. But, you know, you go to the hospital, you get a biopsy, a blood sample that's for some other purpose, like a diagnostic test, and then those samples, as long as your name is removed, those are often stored and used in research, and people don't know. So there is no requirement for consent as long as it's anonymous tissue. And there's no requirement, anonymous or not, about telling people their tissues may become profitable and that someone may, you know, make products using them or develop, you know, things that would become patented that would become valuable.
Well, and we should note one significant change has happened. The cells that came from Henrietta Lacks were essentially named for her, HeLa cells, and science does not do that anymore.
Right, exactly. That's so they anonymize, is what they call it, all tissues that they use. Even, you know, but some of them do have your identity attached in the records because your personal medical history is part of what's interesting to them about the cells. But for them to use that does require consent and a lot of really strict regulation about protecting privacy. But it's the other cells, the millions and millions of samples that are just sort of out there in biobanks. Those are completely anonymous. But, you know, your DNA is inside of them. And we already know that it's possible to find people from anonymous DNA samples. It's been done. It's not something that's done regularly. It's not something that's easy. But there's part of the story of the HeLa cells is in some senses about how science can change and how hard it is to predict what's going to be possible. You know, when they took Henrietta's cells, they didn't know what DNA was. So they didn't know they'd someday be able to look in her cells and learn about her family. They didn't know they'd someday be worth money. So we know now that it's possible to find people using anonymous samples. So what's going to be possible with those supposedly anonymous samples in 50 years? Who knows? So there's a lot of debate about whether anonymizing something even exists anymore.
Do you think, is there something about this controversy that speaks to the kind of long simmering tension between science or scientists and non-scientists of even all races? I mean, at its heart, does science need to do a better job of justifying itself?
Yes, in some ways it is part of this much larger issue. And I think it's less about justifying itself and more about explaining itself. I think the story is so much about the importance of scientists being able to communicate science to the general public and about the general public being open to learning about science. So there's so much of the fear and controversy that surrounds science is more about not understanding than it is about not approving. And scientists aren't generally very good at explaining science to the public, and the public's not very good generally about sort of learning about it. So it's in some ways about the need for that to bridge that gap more, which a lot of scientists are working very hard to do. It's also about, you know, I think the big area of mistrust that exists has to do with commercialization of science. And, you know, people are they want to know what's going on with their tissues. They want to know what's going on in science. And when they find out sort of after the fact that people are using their tissues they didn't know, especially if money's involved, then you get a lot of mistrust. And there's a lot of discussion about who should profit off science. And I think in a lot of ways that's more about our healthcare system than anything else. It, you know, the rationalization is everyone should, you know, donate tissues and because it helps science and everyone benefits from that and from commercializing because it encourages scientific progress. But in our country, not everyone does benefit. So you have people who donate tissues for research that's funded with tax dollars that's then turned into products that are sold back to people. Many of them can't afford it. So I think we'd see less of the controversy about money and commercialization if we had a different healthcare setup.
You write in several places in this book about the Lax family's spirituality and how it informed their ability to process Henrietta's immortal cells, and also how it contrasted with your own view of religion. Do you think you came out of the process of writing this book at all different from a spiritual level?
Oh, sure. I came out of this process different on probably every level. I was raised in a family that was not religious at all. I had no experience with much of religion, and Henrietta's family is very different. They believe very much that her soul is alive in these cells and that she was essentially brought back to life as an angel to take care of people. And, you know, as a science, you know, I have a science background, and in science we often talk about, you know, you hear about science versus religion and the ways that they are opposed to each other. And what I really saw with the Lax family was the ways that the science and religion can work together. You know, if it wasn't for their faith and their belief in her being brought back to life as an angel in these cells, it would have been very difficult and at points traumatizing for them to even really accept that these cells were still living. And, you know, so their faith really helped open them up to learning about the science of the cells and being okay with it. So I learned, you know, I saw a lot of that, but I also, you know, I read the Bible for the first time. I went to church. I was part of, you know, these faith healings and, you know, things that I'd never encountered. And people often ask if it converted me. You know, they say, have you been saved? And the answer is no. I did not change my personal religious beliefs, but it did really teach me a lot about the value of faith and the important role that it plays in people's lives and how positive it can be.
Well, Rebecca Skloot, thanks so much for taking some time with us and helping fill in some more of the story of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be there. Thank you.
Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, published by Crown. She lives in Chicago and spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Our interview with her first aired in 2011. With residency requirements for city employees likely to be lifted when the next budget is passed, we look at how that might affect Milwaukee's real estate market. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.